So first, let me thank the institute for the hospitality. I'm here for the semester. I've been traveling a lot, but I'm here for the next four or five weeks to actually work, collaborate with Luis Lenner on this topic, the science in the gravitational and electromagnetic skies. So in fact, the title of the talk is inspired, comes directly from one of these white papers that I was a co-author of, that was sent to the Decadal Survey. And the thesis, the arguments put forward in the white paper, the main argument is that in the next decade, there is a good chance we'll be able to observe simultaneously a source of radiation in the gravitational and the electromagnetic skies. And there is tremendous added value in observing these sources jointly. There's tremendous added value for the astronomers, but also I think for the fundamental physics. So I'll try to, it's very much an astronomy talk, as you will see, but I'll try to give you, I realize it's a theoretical physics, to give you some reason toward the end of the talk why you might want to care about this, because there might be some interesting, something interesting for theoretical physics. People who work on modification, gravity beyond general relativity maybe, might be tested with this sort of observation. So I need to, I looked at the list of colloquia you had, and you had a talk by Kurt Padler in June, and then Scott Hughes on gravitational waves. So I won't spend so much time introducing the basics of what gravitational waves are. I'm a user of all this body of work that has been done by a lot of physicists. So again, it's very much an astronomy talk, gravitational wave astronomy talk. But I can certainly give you some motivation on the astronomy side for why, for the sort of sources, actually, I'm going to be talking about, astronomical sources I'm going to be talking about. We have very good evidence that there is a massive black hole of a few million solar masses at the center of our galaxy from the motion of stars around it. And similarly, there is pretty good evidence in the sense that most astronomers do not doubt the presence of massive black holes in many galaxies, nearby galaxies, from the measuring the velocity dispersion of the stars. So you don't see the stars move like we can see. We can achieve that in the galactic center. They are too far. But the velocity dispersion is high, and that's a signature of a concentration of mass that is very difficult to explain but by the presence of massive or supermassive black holes. So what we're dealing with here is a notion that maybe at the center of every galaxy, sizable galaxy in the universe, there is a black hole of mass between a million up to billion solar masses. And what we also know, because we see it, is that galaxy merge. That is also an expectation we have from the standard hierarchical model for the formation of galaxy and evolution of structure in the universe. So galaxy merge. At the center, there are these massive black holes. And so we have expectation that through various processes, there is a whole literature in there, I won't tell you so much about this, but through various processes, the two black holes will find their way together, close enough, and finally coalesce. So that's essentially the background motivation behind a lot of what I'm going to tell you about today. And we can see this happening. Or we have evidence that this is happening the way we think it should in a few cases, and that's probably one of the best cases. So that's an optical image of galactic merger remnants. You see this very disturbed morphology here in the optical image is evidence that this was a relatively recent. Recent means in terms of galactic dynamical time, so it's like 100 million years or a fraction of a billion years. But there is evidence through a lot of star formation, for instance, that this was a recent, this is a recent galactic merger. And if you look at the center of this galactic remnant in X-ray with Chandra, in soft X-ray, you see this actually evidence for two luminous sources in X-ray. And if you look at it in hard X-rays, you see them even better. You separate them from the rest of the gas. So in this case, in the X-ray, there is evidence for what we call two active galactic nuclei, or two quasars, if you will. They're the same sort of sources. And what they are is that there is one of the supermassive, the standard model for this, and there is a lot of evidence that supports it, is gas is being actually dumped on these black holes. You bind the gas, you release the binding energy, you thermalize it, the gas is hot, it radiates, and including it radiates in X-rays. There is a lot of non-thermal processes even there. So, but essentially, what you see is gas falling into the very deep potential well of massive black holes. These two, the interpretation here, these two black holes are separated by about a kiloparsec, which is still a very sizable distance. And the phase of interest to us in this talk is a much later phase, when the two black holes are much closer to each other. In fact, the last few orders of magnitude in radius, in units of their Schwarzschild radii, if you will, the last few orders of magnitude is when these two black holes will be radiating copious amount of gravitational waves. And that's what we're hoping to detect with some of the future instruments. And specifically, the instrument that is being planned to do this is this instrument called LISA, Laser Interferometer Space Antenna. And that is actually the second, it's been ranked second in this decadal survey. So it probably won't happen in this decade, but it will start being supported in this decade and will probably fly in the next decade. And a lot of what I will tell you about is based on that mission. So what is it, in essence? It's this constellation of three spacecraft going around the sun. They trail, you can see here, they trail the Earth along its orbit around the sun. And then each, the distance between these three spacecraft is 5 million kilometers. And you have these three test masses. They are in free fall. And there's a lot of technical details in actually achieving this that I will completely sweep under the rug, because for one reason, it's not really my expertise. So I use this as a tool, as I said again. But essentially, these spacecraft are shooting laser at each other. It's an interferometer. And you can measure the fluctuation in space-time as a function of time when one of these gravitational waves passes through. And this instrument has been optimized to detect gravitational waves at the frequency expected from the coalescence of typically a million solar mass black hole. Now, you can do what is traditionally called population synthesis model in astronomy, in astrophysics. It's not extremely reliable, but there is a good case you can make of saying maybe a few percent or percent of all galaxies we look at appear to be very close to each other in the process of merging or remnants of merger. You can count that as function of redshift. You can assume there is a black hole in every such galaxy. You can do sort of the statistics of all this. And then you can ask, per unit redshift, given the distance of this supermassive black hole coalescing, given the sensitivity curve of LISA that you can calculate reliably, how many coalescence am I expected to be able to see per year? And you can do that even per unit redshift. You can split the events per unit redshift. And the answer is that a reasonable model that's not pushing, you know, you can have several hundred if you want to be extremely optimistic. You could have a fraction per year if you want to be very pessimistic. But essentially, the middle ground is that you might expect a few massive black hole coalescence per year per unit redshift. So the idea that this interferometer will be flying like this around the sun for 3 years, 5 years. I guess if it works well, it might be extended to 10 years. Who knows? So you should be able to see quite a lot of number of events. That's the expectation from this massive black hole coalescence. The reason why you see so many, I should say, is because you can see so far. You can see this to really, really very large cosmological distances. And that's one of the things of interest with LISA. Okay, one more thing I want to press upon you is the uniqueness of gravitational wave measurements. I think it may be fair to say that one of the most difficult quantities to measure in astronomy is distance. And that might seem, distance are easily measured on Earth. We get used to with GPS and everything. But in astronomy, it's very hard, because astronomy is entirely the electromagnetic sky. And if you don't know if you're dealing, in principle, you don't know if you're dealing with a bright source that's far away or a source that's close in and faint. And we're dealing with this problem all the time. So there is actually decades of work that go into trying to getting the distance ladder indirectly. And the further you go, especially in cosmological distances, the less you know about the distance. And the errors are typically order a unity, factor of 2, tens of percent, factor of 2. It's very difficult to measure distances in astronomy. And fundamentally, it's because you are limited by the electronic emission from incoherent sources of radiation. And there's nothing really fundamentally that allows you to pin down a distance to an object for the reason I mentioned before. There is something unique about binary black hole, but you know, two-point masses, essentially, in GR, radiating gravitational radiation, and evolving under the loss of momentum and energy that goes into this gravitational radiation, which is that you get, from first principle, you get the distance to the source. And that's amazing. So the way it goes is that the observable you have is this H, which is called strain, which has to do with it's the amplitude of the gravitational waves, and that's also this fractional displacement, this thing in 10 to minus 20, 10 to minus 22, that you might have heard people are trying to measure, you know, fraction of an atom for LIGO. It's just crazily precise measurement. That's the amplitude of the gravitational waves. You have that as a direct observable if you see the signal. Then you have the frequency, because that is modulated at the frequency, and the frequency is directly related to the orbital period of these two-point masses going around each other. But also because the sources are, they are such that their frequency evolve in a humanly tractable timescale. And specifically, the sources that will be seen by LISA, you will see them sweep a large range of frequency before they finally coalesce, actually. So there is also a direct observable that f dot, the time derivative of the frequency in the gravitational waves. And it's amazing. GR was known, you know, GR has been known for decades. It's amazing that Schütz, Werner Schütz, is the director of the Albert Einstein Institute in Germany, in 86 was the first one apparently to realize that to leading order in the gravitational wave signal, the combination of the observable of the amplitude of the waves, the frequency, and the frequency derivative actually is such that this mass combination that we call the chirp mass, so it's a combination of the two masses of these point masses, this M1, M2 to the 3/5 divided by M1 plus M2 to the 1/5. It's just one combination that comes out in this gravitational wave decay for the sources. That cancels out, and you get directly the lunacy distance to the source. So it's a fundamental measure of distance based directly on gravity. That's something we do not have in astronomy. What you don't get, however, is a redshift. There's this little d, which is usually what we get in astronomy. When we measure the spectrum of a galaxy, it's receding from the shift in the lines. We also do that for stars, you know. The spectral shift tells us, so on a cosmological scale, the spectral shift, the redshift tells us something about the distance. But that's measured by the shift in the spectral line in an electromagnetic spectrum. But you don't get any information about the redshift from the gravitational waves. And that's this little z here says that there's a 1 plus z times the chirp mass, 1 plus z times the chirp mass, in fact. And because that cancels out, that says you get the distance, but you have no information about the redshift. That's related fundamentally to degeneracy in general relativity, that mass and time scales, or frequencies, if you will, are actually degenerating GR. So there's nothing you can do about it. It's fundamental. However, imagine that you were able to tell in which galaxy these two black holes are coalescing. Oh, I've just coalesced. Then you take a spectrum of that galaxy, and then astronomers are very good at this. They'll tell you the redshift to, a great many significant digits, a few significant digits. So you get the redshift very accurately. And I'll show you in a moment that you also get this distance very accurately from LISA. It's amazing the accuracy you can achieve. So what we're talking about is that if we can find the galaxy in which these two black holes are coalescing, by combining the gravitational wave signal with the redshift of the galaxy, you can draw a gravitational version of Hubble diagram, luminosity distance versus redshift. And what's nice, really, that fundamentally that's new, because the distance in that Hubble diagram has been measured gravitationally. So this is where there might be surprises. If somehow photons and gravitons don't propagate the way we think, you might start imagining that a Hubble diagram done purely electromagnetically, which is what astronomers do these days, might disagree at some level with one that is done with a distance measured by gravitation. That's one of the things that I'll conclude with at the end.
Mm-hmm. Is there any model that would an alteration of gravity or electromagnetism that you would see this way, and it's already constrained from other constraints that you have.
That you would see what?
You would detect it in this way, but it's not already.
Yes. So I'll yes and no. I'll tell you about BGP towards the end.
Okay.
Where you have a leakage. So that's one of the things. Mm-hmm. Let's get into the conclusion of my talk. If you work on modified gravity, quantum gravity might be a bit far, but if you work on modified gravity and you have any theory that says that in the infrared, and I mean on cosmological scales, you expect a different propagation of gravitons versus photons, this might be a beautiful laboratory to test this. This is really what the conclusion of this talk for this audience, I think. And now in practice, it's hard to get such large deviation that we're not able to measure them. It's a usual thing. But maybe we can go back to that after, toward the end. Okay, so accuracy. So again, let me make here a statement. For the solar system orbits, we know to amazing accuracy, many significant digits. We can measure the eclipses and transit of planets or stars to actually great many significant digits in astronomy. We can do that. The orbital period is measured very accurately. Then we can solve for the structure of the sun from seismology at maybe a percent or a few percent accuracy. But I might be forgetting something, but essentially that's the only thing we do in astronomy at percent precision. Everything else tends to be 10% or order of magnitude, right? So that's the background. Astronomers are not used to the accuracies we're dealing with here. So you can show for a typical massive black hole binary, million solar mass at redshift 1, so already at quite a large cosmological distance. Don't look at the best typical worst here has to do with the inclination of the binary relative to LISA orbit, the time, the amount of time you integrate, there's various things that will play into sources are not all equal. So let's take the typical, if you will. And you have this, the leading order mass combination that comes is this chirp mass that I already mentioned, this big M here, the chirp mass. You get it to a very, very small fraction of a percent. And then there's additional signal deviations from the leading order quadrupolar, if you will, expansion that you might do for your gravitational wave. There is actually extra deviation from the detailed phasing and various things of the decay. You can get the other mass combination, reduced mass, M1, M2 over M1 plus M2. And that you get somewhat at a less accurate level, but it's still, you can see here, it's a tenth of a percent for this case. So that means you can combine these two and get the two masses individually at better than percent precision. But maybe even more, so we don't know if we have never measured a black hole mass at percent precision. The black hole mass at the center of our galaxy from things is like known at factor of 2, I would say. We're going to do like sub-percent precision with this. It's amazing. It's revolutionary. And maybe who cares knowing the mass of a black hole very precisely? Is that important? Well, we can argue. But knowing the distance to a fraction of a percent, that is something you can use. That's pretty amazing too. So this is all LISA. You can do a model of the LISA data stream, the instrument, and all this, and you can ask this parameter estimation technique that people use a lot in cosmology. This is what comes out for LISA. It's been done by many people. So it's amazingly precise. Now the column that we'll focus on for a while in this talk is this last one, this delta omega. And that has to do with the accuracy with which you can, just using the data stream of LISA, point out to a patch in the sky from where these gravitational waves are coming. So you can point and help astronomers look for the right galaxy in the sky. And you see the accuracy is of order a few degrees squared. So we'll come back to that.
What's new again? I know you said it, but could
chirp
you
mass.
Pardon me? That's the chirp mass.
Chirp mass and then reduced mass.
And reduced, okay.
So it's two different combinations of the masses, yes. Yeah. I'll get to that. There is no notion that you have to include weak lensing in the sense that the measurement itself is that precise. You cannot use it to do cosmology because of weak lensing. So I think I'll try to elucidate that a bit later, yeah. The point is that you will get that precise measurement in that direction for that binary, but that line of sight DL of Z is not representative of the universe because of inhomogeneities. Okay, so how does that work? Well, if you think you have one of these two black hole binaries in the process of coalescing and you observe it for a year, and from GR you have a pretty good idea of the stream of gradual waves, how the frequency increases with time, the amplitude increases with time as these two black holes decay, it's a source that's located in the sky. Well, that's a bit too much light. Thank you. And now look at this constellation of three satellites. It goes around the sun every year. So in about a year, which is the time it takes for these two binaries to coalesce, if you look at the setup here, that's graphically illustrated, you will modulate the signal on the year timescales. So there is information in the way essentially you are changing the orientation of your antenna, you can think of it that way, over half a year or year timescale. So there is information in the signal in that modulation that tells you where to look. And this is where this error, so the degree squared in the sky, comes from, typically. Okay, so this is really what where I wanted to get to. So you get up order degree squared, maybe a few degree squared for some of the more distant sources. And the next point I want to make is things are better actually, for astronomers, that these things are better. This is the typical error that we get from parameter estimation, integrating the entire signal down to final coalescence. But actually, if you think of what I just told you, because to localize, so it is the case that the strongest signal you get from two black holes coalescing is when they are about to coalesce. This is when the amplitude is largest. So in terms of, if you ask when do I accumulate the signal, it is at the very end, the final few orbits. But the modulation itself cannot come from just one day. It has to be accumulated over at least a month, because you need to modulate, actually, that signal significantly. So even though most of the signal, in terms of amplitude of the gradual waves, is at the end, the final information, which is a few degrees squared, you must have that before the final coalescence, well before, because you have to be able to modulate the signal for at least a fraction of a year to be able to localize it. So what I'm saying is that you will get some information about a few degrees squared well before the two black holes coalesce. And that's fantastic for astronomy. It's a warning that something dramatic is happening in a galaxy somewhere in the sky. And that point had been until 2006, nobody had really calculated the time dependence of this localization error on the sky. So that's relatively new. And I think that's just one of the things that has led to a lot of work in this area. So let me show you a calculation that was done by a former graduate student of mine, Ben Secoxis. That appeared in this white paper. What is shown here is time prior to merger in days. And again, I believe it will be, it's a million solar mass black hole at redshift 1. And what is shown here is the angular error in arc minutes on the sky. So I have to apologize. Astronomer I'm going to use ergs and arc minutes and all this. The point is that this is about, I believe, actually, that's 10 degrees squared. 10 degrees squared. If you square it, you say it's actually a spherical shape. You don't worry about the shape. There are issues with the shape, actually. I won't get there. Essentially, at early times, a year, see, this is 300 days. So a year before coalescence, you have very little information. 6 months after, however, you have modulated significantly the signal. It may still merge only a few months later, but you have modulated enough that you have some information. So that's a collapse of the error as function of time prior to merger. And you reach a few degrees squared here, but you have pretty much that information you see days to weeks before. And that's a good news for astronomers. So what that means is that when LISA flies, people will reduce the data. They will see a strong signal. There are two black holes coalescing. They look at them in the sky. They look at them, reduce the data stream, and then send an email, you know, a telegram, we call that, to astronomers, and they'll tell them, Tuesday, in 2 weeks from now, in that region of the sky, there is a black hole of this mass and this mass that will be merging. please look. This is what's going to happen.
I don't think you'll need to
show. Yes.
Yeah. What sets the balance between worst and best?
So, as I said, that has to do with the... The constellation is not uniform to the location of the source in the sky. For instance, there is an orbital plane, right? So it's a location in the sky, but also the orientation of the binary, because whether you get plus or cross polarization, etc. So all of this is sort of factored in this worst and best. Yeah, there is a range of possibilities. Yeah. Okay, and so the last point, the reason why you have this thing here, LSST and SASSER, which is a proposed infrared telescope, is that this matches well what astronomers want to do in the future. In fact, the most highly rated ground-based project from this decadal survey of astronomy, we're going back to that, is this thing, is LSST, Large Synoptic Telescope, Survey Telescope. And that is a 10-degree squared field of view looking at the sky every 3 days, doing a photometric survey of the sky in 6 minutes every 3 days. So it's perfectly matched, in a sense, to the search for any signal in the electromagnetic sky that might accompany the coalescence of these two black holes. This is really where I'm getting here. So it matches the what the astronomers want to do in the future, in the next decade. Yeah?
So what is 200 arc minutes for LSST?
We have the LSST limit, this is square root of 10. This is the linear size, so it's square root of 10 degrees in arc minutes. Yeah. So that's a field of view of LSST. And then you drop to the field of view, which is more like a square degree here. Yeah. Yeah, in fact, I should mention that Ryan Lang, who is a student of Scott Hughes, PhD student of Scott Hughes, did this very nice work where they showed that, in fact, so we did this with a simplified model, and our model for this collapse of the localization error as function of time is probably valid down to day or a few days. At late time, there's additional modulation from spin effects in the binaries that add modulation to the signal, and you can use that to do better than what this is. So in some of the best cases, you can collapse the error further just a few hours to a few arc minutes. So there is even a neural time, there might be a rush in the few hours before the final coalescence to analyze the data and help the astronomers look better at a better location in the sky. So there's a lot of things that... might happen there that's not obvious to do in practice, actually. But it's interesting. Yeah.
What about the masses that are coalescing, and how does that affect your prediction?
You know the masses. So already 2 weeks before, you know the masses at percent precision or better. And you know when the coalescence happens at a few phases, so a few orbits, and an orbit is 100 seconds. So you have so much information. You know, essentially, to within a few minutes, if you will, when the coalescence will happen. Already, you know that well in advance. So you can tell astronomers, Tuesday at that time, that hour, that those minutes, this coalescence will happen. Yeah. It's really amazing.
Do you expect the electromagnetic signal to peak at LSST frequencies? Or?
Okay, so then we get into the dirty astrophysics, and I want to get there. This is why I'm here, collaborating with Lewis. I'm trying to motivate sincere. Okay, so as I said, LSST is an example, and it will happen, 10 degrees square field of view, 6 bands, all sky survey every 3 nights, and repeatedly it goes deeper and deeper and deeper as the survey goes. But what's interesting is that it's a survey instrument, so it's been designed to do this, survey the sky, well, half the sky, really. You cannot survey the whole sky from a given location on Earth, half the sky, and then you redo half the sky every 3 days. But they are now contemplating having an option to stop their survey mode when NISA says, there is such a black hole coalescing Tuesday, you know? Stopping their mode and look at this area to try to catch up anything. So astronomers are sort of getting on the bandwagon. You're thinking, okay, this is really interesting. We have to try doing this. And this is just LSST, but your question is perfectly valid. In fact, I told you about X-rays. Is it in the optical that you want to do this? Is it in X-rays? Is it in radio? There's a lot of questions that are valid here, and we don't have answers, I'd say. And the answer might be that you want to look in every single part of the electromagnetic spectrum you can. Because if you believe astrophysicists to have a forward predicting model for the electromagnetic counterpart, I think that's very optimistic. it's hard to predict. We can have, and in fact, what I'll tell you about is sort of time models for what might happen, but it's going to be very difficult to predict reliably what's going to happen from the point of view of the electromagnetic signature. That's right. So I'll tell you a bit more about this, actually. That's the second half of the talk. Yeah. All right, so that might sound good, a few degrees squared. At redshift 1, millions of mass black hole, even accreting at Eddington, which is this limiting velocity at which radiation pressure blows up the gas. Radiation pressure dominates over the gravitational pull from the black hole. So the Eddington limit is supposed to be a limit at which a steady ball of gas, if you will, around a black hole can radiate. It's hard to imagine how you can radiate more. It's very difficult. So if you put such a bright gas, luminous gas, around millions of mass black hole at redshift 1, that's actually still a pretty faint source. You still have to go to big telescope to detect it. It's not entirely trivial. So you have to go faint. Now, when you go faint, you find a lot of galaxies in the sky. And in a few degrees, in a degree squared, you find a lot of galaxies. So I think this might not be obvious to physicists, I think. But let me show you. This is a Hubble Deep Field, which might be a good way of looking at this. You know, you may want to go over this degree squared as deep as the Hubble Deep Field. But this is 3 arc minutes squared. You're going to have to tile several tens or hundreds of this thing on the sky. So you will have a zillion galaxies that might be hosting these two black holes that are in the process of merging. So having an information on the degree squared might sound great. It's a small fraction of the sky. But at faint magnitude, there's so many galaxies there. There's just 10,000 here in this like spread over a large amount of redshift that it is actually not, you cannot just pick a unique galaxy like this. You need some extra information. And so you need an efficient search strategy for the galaxy. And the way you can do this is to think a little bit more about what you might be able to expect from for the electromagnetic counterpart of these black hole coalescences. And so the second part of the talk is really telling you about this. So if you remember my third slide, I had this like this example of these two black holes in a galactic remnant being brought together, and there's this X-ray emitting gas around the two black holes. That tells us, and we sort of know that also from, that tells us something that we also know from simulating galaxy mergers on the computer, is that when you do that, you tend to drive gas all the way toward the center in the vicinity of the black holes. And that's because you can torque the gas. It loses its angular momentum and makes it all the way to the center. So it's sort of natural to expect gas to accompany the black holes as they make it toward the bottom, the potential well of the galaxy. So the entire idea behind the rest of the talk is that we don't want clean black hole mergers. We want dirty ones. And dirty means we want the gas around. Even a little bit of gas might do it. We don't want this to happen in vacuum. If you coalesce two black holes in vacuum, there is no electromagnetic radiation. In GR, at least, that's very clear, right? So you need to put gas around. And the idea that you put gas around, and the event is so dramatic, so energetic, so violent, that you perturb the gas, and that gas flashes towards you, some signal. And that happened at the time when two black holes coalesce. So now you're in much better shape. You're looking at these zillion galaxies in the sky, but there is only one at that time when the two black holes coalesce that is producing some variable signal of a nature you might say, oh, I think that corresponds to what I expect from these two black holes coalescing. So the whole business now, well, the business Luis and I are in, to some extent, is to understand the nature of these electromagnetic counterparts. And I'll tell you about, I'll just give you a few examples of what people have been doing in terms of a precursor signal. So actually, some emission characteristic signal before the coalescence of the two black holes, some prompt signal, electromagnetic signal, just when the two black holes coalesce, and some afterglow, something that might happen after, but you might trace to the as being the consequence of the merger of the black holes. So let me give you some numbers here. Because that's also something that's not entirely obvious, I think, unless you've looked at it. These massive black hole mergers are extremely energetic events. The amount, essentially a few percent of the rest mass of the black hole is radiated in gravitational waves. So that, for a million solar mass black hole, that stands to 58 ergs. radiated about in the last. So there's a, if you want to go to joules, there's a 10 to the 7 factor here. And that's radiated in just a few orbits, which is a few hundred seconds. So in terms of luminosity, so that might not mean much again, because, you know, what does that mean? The luminosity, so 10 to the 58 ergs in 100 seconds, is a luminosity in Gaussian waves that is like 10 to the 56 ergs per second. That is 10 to the 23 solar luminosity. There is about 100 billion solar stars in our galaxy, and the sun is typical. There is about 100 billion galaxies in the visible universe. So that's 10 to the 11 times 10 to the 11, 10 to the 22. When this thing shines, it outshines all the stars in the universe. Just for 100 seconds, it is just the brightest thing radiating energy in the universe. It outshines everything in the visible universe. So it's extremely energetic. The issue is that it's far away, and Gaussian waves are very difficult to detect. So this is why it's been so difficult to build an instrument to do this. But in principle, there's a huge amount. So you're hoping to tap a little bit of that at the Earth with LISA. The good news for electromagnetic counterpart is that if you can tap even a part in a billion of a part in a billion of a billion of that energy, a tiny amount of that, you deposit in the gas, that can power you something, a firework that you might be able to see. So there's a huge amount of energy and energy involved. You just need to tap a small fraction of it to be able to have a bright electromagnetic counterpart. How might you couple, in a sense, this gravitational wave energy flux that's leaving the binary and the gas? One thing that happens is that if the gas is bound to the black hole binary, like in a bound in the sense of an accretion disk, so maybe I'll tell you a little bit more about the accretion disk in a moment. What happens from the point of view of the gas, and when the two black holes coalesce, as I mentioned, the system loses a few percent of the rest mass. So you have this system that's bound to the black hole, but suddenly, from the point of view of the gas that's distant enough, mass has disappeared because it goes into gravitational waves. So that is going to drive perturbations, gravitational perturbations in the gas. Similarly, numerical relativity has shown that when you coalesce two black holes, you generally expect some linear momentum. So gravitational waves leave the system with some finite amount of linear momentum. And by the law of action, by action and reaction, there is a reflex motion of the black hole. So you actually recoil this black hole, typically at a few hundred kilometers per second, maybe more in some cases. So what that means is that from the point of view of the environment of the black hole, just after coalescence, you have this million solar mass black hole recoiling at several hundred kilometers per second. And that's a way for you to deposit kinetic energy of that motion in the environment, right? And you can ask how much kinetic energy is it? It's 10 to the 53 ergs, a million solar mass black hole, 100 kilometers per second. You can tap into 10 to the 53 ergs of mechanical energy, kinetic energy, to deposit in the environment. A supernova is 10 to the 51 ergs. That's 100 supernovae. So in principle, this black hole recoiling there is 100 times as kinetic energy that can be deposited in the environment, in the gas around the black hole, 100 times more than a supernova. So there's a lot of energy. That's the case I'm trying to make here. How that happens exactly is where we are struggling.
Yeah. And there are servers for those. So how come we haven't seen this one?
Okay, so that's my last bullet. See, rare events.
But how rare?
They're very rare.
Like once every century? Once.
Well, so it depends a little bit how faint you look. So that's the thing, is that the transient sky, which is another thing that will be pushed very strongly in the next decade and beyond. You know, we have looked at everywhere in the electromagnetic spectrum as astronomers, but there is one thing we have not done, is to survey the sky at faint magnitude repeatedly. And that's sort of one of the next frontiers in the electromagnetic sky, is to actually look at the faint transient sky. And as you go faint, you'll see a lot. Already, supernovae are not so difficult to find, but they tend to be relatively nearby.
The ones that deal with cosmology, they're not too
big. Right, so If you do the mass, you look at it, you'll find that these are actually very rare events, and it makes sense you haven't seen them.
But if they are too rare, then we wouldn't see them with this eye there.
Except you know where to look and when to look. That's the key. You know, it's like finding tidal disruption theory. You throw the star, it's a rare event, and then you have this big flash, and it lasts for not so long. If you don't know where to look and when to look, you have to survey everything. That's hard. The sky is big. It's a lot of resources. If you know when to look and where to look, and you know the masses involved and the distance to some extent, you, I think, have a much better chance to finding this rare
event. But if it doesn't happen, if it happens every 100 years, then it doesn't happen. So
no, it does happen. I told you a few year per unit redshift.
Okay, so a few years.
It does happen. It's just that the electromagnetic surveys have not been done yet that can find this. And they would be helped by the gravitational wave signal. That's the thing.
And LISA effectively sees the whole sky at once, I guess, right?
Yeah, I didn't
say
that.
That's the difference from optical.
Yes, I should have said that. You can detect this massive black hole coalescences just barely above the noise curve of LISA, out to which 10 or 15.
Over the whole sky. I guess there's
some
planes which are less favored, presumably, because of
yes,
the configuration.
Yes. But the reach of LISA is huge, yes. I think that's the way of saying it. Yeah. So I'm running a little bit out of time, so I will want to cut a little bit on the astrophysics here. So I try to make the case that we generally expect gas to be present in the vicinity of these two black holes. So this is the setup for a toy model, power matrix where there's the more massive black hole at the center, there's a disk of matter around it, then there's a secondary black hole that opens a gap in this disk of gas, and there is a circumbinary disk there. The reason why we expect the gas to settle into a disk is simply because it's easy for gas to cool by radiation, but photons carry very little momentum. So gas can generally cool, but it's very difficult to lose its angular momentum, and therefore it finds itself rotationally supported. That's why you form so many disks in astrophysics. The cooling gets rid of the energy, but you're left with a lot of angular momentum. You're rotationally supported. And then the process by which you actually make it onto a black hole, like in a quasar, has to do with what this thing called viscosity. That has to do with friction in the gas that transports angular momentum. So you actually transport angular momentum outward. It's a proper turbulent transport, and the gas makes it in on successive Keplerian orbit. You remove angular momentum, so you go down the potential wave. As you go down the potential wave, you bind the gas into this potential further and further. The binding energy is dumped into the gas, it's radiated, that's what powers quasars, essentially. So you can do analogs of this simple accretion disk model, but in the presence of two black holes, and try to figure out exactly what might be going on. And one of the things that you find is that, so now this is a surface density in the gas disks around the primary black hole here. This is log of radius in unit of Schwarzschild radii for the big black hole. This cross here is a second black hole, somewhat smaller, factor of 10 mass ratio. And then you have this gap. By tidal interaction, you have this gap. And then gas actually acts as a sink of angular momentum, so it pushes the second black hole in. But at some point, gravitational radiation becomes so efficient that the merger time just by the action of gravitational radiation is faster than anything the gas can do viscously in terms of friction. Friction is slow. So what happens, if I show you this again, then you go back here, is that you see here the gas sort of tracks and follows the evolution in concert with the secondary black hole. But at some point, you will freeze this evolution here, and you'll actually squeeze the mass here, because the black hole, you see the black hole is taking a distance from this disk is not able to viscously evolve, and then the disk inside here is tidally squeezed by this black hole that is radiating Gaussian waves at a very copious rate. And so what happens is that in sort of a sudden event, this little bit of mass that you have inside, in between the two black holes, is bound. You actually force it tidally. You bind it by tidal interaction. You bind it to the big black hole at the center, and that actually gives you potential for a precursor signal. By binding rather quickly this small amount of mass at the center, you can have a precursor signal with a very characteristic light curve. So that's one way we might actually find something going on a few days before the coalescence. There might be this bright source appearing there. The other thing that might happen is that after the black holes have coalesced, these two black holes have coalesced here, this gas here is viscous in the sense it does have a tendency to the gas does have friction. It does have a tendency to redistribute its angular momentum. And what's going to happen is that this huge amount of mass that has piled up here to actually capture all the angular momentum of the secondary in its orbit to allow it to merge will actually flow in like in a quasar. So effectively, and I don't have actually a movie of that, but following the actual disappearance of the inner circumprimary disk and the coalescence of the second black hole with the primary black hole, this pileup amount of mass here that had the two black holes coalesce will flow in on a typical viscous time scale. And you can estimate what that is from accretion disk theory. We have some idea. And that's about 10 years. And that scales for a million center mass black hole, given 100 Schwarzschild radii gas. You dump 100 Schwarzschild gas at 100 Schwarzschild radii around a million center mass black hole. We have some understanding of the magnitude of viscosity and friction in this gas. In 10 years, it will just flow in and be an accrete on this black hole. So what that means is that 10 years after this coalescence in this region of the sky that we know where the two black holes coalesce, there should be essentially, we should witness the birth of a quasar. But that's a very different quasar than usual quasars. So that's one of the points I want. Why is, I said there's tremendous added value to doing this. When we look at a quasar, like these two X-ray luminous sources I showed you, we don't know the masses of the black hole. We don't know anything. We can guess them at the order of magnitude level, but we don't know anything. Here, we know the orientation. We know the masses. We know the spins of the black hole before coalescence. That means we know the spin predictively. You know, you can do numerical relativity. You know the spin after. So we are talking about witnessing the birth of a quasar, knowing everything you want to know about the black hole, its mass, its spin, its orientation relative to you. So that's just the best quasar ever an astronomer will have ever looked at, because you'll be able to actually understand how this gas flows and how the matter radiates. So it's truly a new laboratory for black hole accretion physics. Okay, let me show you. There's a lot of activity on the prompt phase, and Lewis is involved in this, so I want to emphasize this a little bit. Because there's this gas that is piled up around the two black holes prior to the coalescence, and this gas is usually ionized. It has like 100,000 Kelvin temperatures, maybe a million Kelvin. Well, let's say 100,000 Kelvin temperature is ionized, 10,000, 100,000 Kelvin. It is able to sustain, it should be magnetized, ionized, magnetized. It should be able to sustain a significant magnetic field. So it is likely that these two black holes at the center that are coalescing, forget about this inner disk. Let's say there is no disk. You imagine these two black holes. It is very likely that there will be also some magnetic field there in the environment. So one of the things that people have done, there is a pretty movie here that turns out to be solving the coalescence of two black holes in GR, full GR, and at the same time solving Maxwell's equation. So people are starting to look at what happens to the electromagnetic field as two black holes coalesce, something that had not been done before. And the state of the art is actually Lewis' work here. So the movie is less pretty, but it's actually much better. This is actually not just Maxwell's equation. It's solving this approximation to what we call force-free MHD. This is magnetic field plus a tenuous amount of matter, which is actually much more realistic. So solving the full numerical relativity, you add a little bit of plasma, there's a magnetic field, electric field, magnetic field there, you solve all of this from first principle. And what they see come out here, what's represented is a pointing flux. That's normal, coming out normal to the orbital plane of the two black holes. They see essentially this pointing electromagnetic flux going away from the two black holes. It's something like a transient double jet. And that would be a very characteristic signature that we might expect from the coalescence of these two black holes. So there's a lot of interplay these days between numerical relativity and some scenarios that come from astrophysics where you might expect this electromagnetic field, the plasma, the gas around. And essentially what I'm telling you is that people are trying to figure out every way they can the nature of this electromagnetic counterparts when two black holes coalesce and there is gas around. That's essentially. And there's a lot more work to be done. You want to say anything else, please, about this?
No.
It's good? Okay, so this is candies, and I don't know if they're really candies. Maybe they will be sour. But I'm trying to get the theoretical physicists out of here, so just a few slides. What if there is new physics on cosmological scales? And I'll give you two examples of things I can imagine we could do. And there might be more. And they essentially have to do with the notion that if you have some understanding of the electromagnetic counterpart that's coming out of this system of two black hole coalescing, and you witness the Gaussian waves, you have some idea of when you should receive some amount of Gaussian wave at some frequency, and when you should receive some amount of electromagnetic waves at some frequencies. And so if somehow, on cosmological scales, the photons and gravitons do not propagate, you know, let's say at the speed of light, the way, well, I think photon we know, or we think we know at least. It's not necessarily a bit tricky, but if there's a difference between the two propagation, is what I'm saying, you might be able to see it with these sources, because they jointly emit with a well-timed, in a well-timed source, they jointly emit electromagnetic waves and gravitational waves. I need to finish soon. So one of the things that has excited people about, and I mentioned that before, is about these sources, is the possibility of doing gravitational over diagrams. So one of the things that's interesting here, so this is an example of a supernova Hubble diagram. Just look at the blue line for now. I'll discuss the red line in a moment. But this is what people do from a few years ago, what people do, and then they measure supernovae, and then they measure the Lucy distance, but they have to calibrate the limacy of the California supernovae from local supernovae. And then when you see far away from the brightness, they infer the distance. And you see the error bars here. And the issue is that if some of our supernovae over cosmological times, ultraviolet one or two, evolve, or there is dependence in your metallicity and your environment, you know, the supernova is a complicated, it has a lot of degrees of freedom. So there might be things that we don't understand about supernovae that biases this calibration. The great thing about this distance that you get from the black hole coalescence is that it's essentially self-calibrated. That's another way of saying you get the distance for free from fundamental physics, that's GR. And if you don't get it right, something is wrong, that's very good, because it tells you GR is not right. So anyway, somehow it's very screwed up, you've learned something as well. There is no absorption or scattering of gravitons. You know, once they're emitted, essentially there's nothing that happens to them. So it's a very thin signal, much thinner than electromagnetic waves that can be actually messed up with. And you can probably go to larger redshifts. You might hope to go to larger redshifts, maybe 3 or 4 with these sources, black hole binaries, as opposed to supernovae. So it's going to be very hard to go to redshifts 3 or 4. Well, some of the space mission might do it. So people got excited about this. Especially because your measurement of the redshift is to the accuracy of the spectrograph. It's very precise, it's so significantly. And I told you, the Lucy distance is measured from LISA also at a fraction of a percent. So it sounds like it's a very precise measurement. The issue is that measurement, that line of sight, has some fluctuation in the potential that due to the matter distribution, due to the fact that the universe is inhomogeneous. And so one line of sight, no matter how precise it is not good enough. You want several line of sights, an average over length, to have an average relation between Lucy distance and redshift. That's what you want to the cosmology with this Hubble diagram. And it is not obvious that you get many sources, many black hole coalescence as function of redshift, each of them finding an electromagnetic counterpart, so that you will be able to draw a Gaussian diagram that is competitive with other techniques. So it would be a confirmation, maybe, tool, but it's not obvious that it's competitive with other methods like weak lensing and supernovae to do cosmology. So weak lensing is a limitation. You have a very precise measurement, but you can use it to do cosmology, which is a bit frustrating.
Roughly, what does the scatter work out to be in the distance module?
Yeah, so I would say maybe redshift 2, the number I have in mind is maybe 10%. Mm-hmm. So it's quite significant. So you need many sources to collapse that. And the measurement you have is fraction of a percent, maybe 10 to minus 3, even at redshift 2. So you have a very precise measurement. But that line of sight has so much fluctuation, you need to average over many sources.
in the future, if we have many of these, you can actually use it to measure the fluctuations.
Okay, so 100 years from now, when gravitational astronomy is a well-developed field, you will be doing this. In fact, this is what Kurt Kepler told you a few months ago. In the future, this is going to be amazing when you have many, many sources. But not for now. Okay. So let me mention two possibilities, and I'll finish with these two slides. In some of the modified gravity scenarios that theoretical physicists have considered, you know, there's this notion that we live on this brain, and then gravity operates on, at least in the infrared, on very large cosmological scales, in one or maybe more extra dimensions. And so there's a leakage of gravity in the extra dimension. So if that were to happen, if and you can actually work this out in the theories to some extent. You expect some leakage. If somehow you let this gravitational wave propagate on cosmological scales, you can lose some of the energy flux in the gravitational waves to the extra dimension, to the bulk in this theory. So what he would say is that you measure a source that is fainter than what you should get. And if that leakage is significant, he would say the distance would be excessive compared to what you would get from a purely electromagnetic measurement, because in these theories, you constrain electromagnetism to be on the brain. So that's one example. It's toy model, I'm not pushing for it. It's one example where you might find a discrepant electromagnetic Hubble diagram or compared to a gravitational Hubble diagram. Okay? If you have any theory that can do that, that's very interesting. Let me give you, and then the other example I would use is, just to be short on this, is that the electromagnetic signal, naively you expect to trail the gravitational signal, because what perturbs the gas at the strongest point of the merger, when the two black holes coalesce, that's the most violent part, is actually this time variable quadrupole or gravitational field. So that information propagates at the speed of light, it perturbs the gas around, and that generates an electromagnetic signal. So you expect the most luminous part of the gravitational signal to arrive before the most luminous part of the electromagnetic signal you might get. If somehow the electromagnetic flash in this simple picture precedes the gravitational flash, it tells you your gravity, your gravitons are propagating slower than the speed of light, or it points towards this. So again, that's one way of saying, if somehow there is a differential propagation on cosmological scale, this is the only tool I'm aware we get to do this measurement. If there's anything weird in the propagation of gravitons on cosmological scale, different than light, you might be able to test this with these sources. And that's two avenues I can see, and I'm inviting you, really, as theoretical physicists, to think about ways in which a modified gravity theory in the infrared might lead to some detectable signal in the, with these sources. And I'll conclude with that. So I've tried to argue that LISA could jumpstart this field of gravitational wave astronomy, by finding this, helping astronomers find these electromagnetic counterparts of massive black hole binary mergers. There is a lot of trickiness in doing this. It's very time constrained. And so that's not the way astronomers are used to do things, to be told, oh, look in this region of the sky at that time, or whatever. But it seems like they reorganize themselves for a bit to do that. And if we are able to find at least some electromagnetic counterparts for some of this massive black hole coalescence, there is a potential there for comparing the propagation of light and gravity, or linearized gravity, if you will, on cosmological scales. And we might be surprised in principle, which would be great. Thank you.
Okay, so for starters, do any students have questions? Real students.
If the speed of gravitons was lower than photons, would you see like an analog of Cherenkov radiation coming off large
bodies? So that's a good question. Someone mentioned that to me earlier, and I think someone pointed out to me a paper where you can get actually some Cherenkov radiation. But I've not looked at this, so there might be people in the room who might answer the question better. But I believe it's not impossible, yes.
So have you looked into just sort of classical effects well before the merger where the two black holes will be perturbing a disk around, and the disk is much less massive than the black holes, So you might expect to set up instabilities and actually be extremely active well before the merger. It would sort of mess up this test that you have, but it also may increase the probability that you could identify this thing and study it well before the coalescence. So that would, and I think that would be a purely classical calculation that you could do.
Yes.
Is anybody doing that? Or
yes.
Done that?
I think the answer is yes. So I had this slide with fancy movies of this electromagnetic and gravitational field, and I have these two items, like numerical relativity and then astrophysics. And the astrophysics, all this work has been part of it looking at exactly what you're saying. You know, prior to the coalescence, can you perturb the disk there, and what would be the signature? So astrophysics are also looking at this from a classical view, not just at the prompt signal, but... people are looking at every single scenario they can think of to produce an electromagnetic counterpart and what might be the signature.
Is it unique from, say, what we see in what we think are single quasars, for example? Do you get a signal that's unique?
Yes. So I would say when the two black holes are separated by... let me give you an example. When the two black holes are separated by 100 Schwarzschild radii or a bit more, so before this phase where the two black holes go... quite is very fast and they leave the gas around, you might have orbital times of months. So it's actually even before the LISA phase, before it appears visible in the LISA phase, these two black holes are there and they go around and there is this polypolar potential, you know, that goes and perturbs the disk. So people are starting to think that when they go LSST, for instance, or other very faint transient sky surveys, they might be looking... it's rare sources, but they might be looking at some unusual, maybe quasar or center of a galaxy where there would be a periodic signal on the orbital frequency or multiples of the orbital frequency. So people are starting to look into this, yes. Variable sources at the center of galaxies might be the progenitors of these mergers in the Gaussian wave sky. There's some more on this. I don't think it's been exhausted at all.
At the beginning of your talk, you mentioned something about the decadal study in LISA starting now with what I assume is not this decade, but the 20s. Is that correct? Like, when can we expect LISA to be launched realistically?
You want to know about the politics?
Basically.
But I'm not a politician.
I'm digging for dirt, okay?
But, yeah. My understanding is... There is a special footnote in the decadal survey. It's not a footnote, actually. It's a pretty prominent that says that LISA Pathfinder has to fly successfully. LISA Pathfinder is actually one of the key thing in LISA is that you have to have these free falling test masses because they are the ones that are susceptible to the passage of the gravitational waves. And so to test that. And then you have to have this enclosure with micro thrusters around, and then you have to be able to follow this free-falling test mass without any physical contact. So there's this technology there that's not obvious. It's a bit tricky. This Pathfinder is to test this component. So I don't know if you can think of it as one flying rather than a three constellation, not quite, but something like this. This is done by the European. I'm told that they spend between 200 and half a billion euro on this. So it's very significant. It should fly in 2013. A year ago, it should be 2011, so 2013. Mm-hmm. If that fails, that's a significant technological challenge for LISA, and the decadal survey says, then we should go down the list and pass LISA and do something else. If that succeeds, then I believe there is a funding line, or if you look at the decadal survey, that says you have to start giving money for LISA, real deal 2015, 2017, you start ramping up the money. So you start really getting into designing, in building LISA, if you will, in the middle of the decade or later part of the decade, and it will fly in the next decade. So it is really in this decade, but it will fly in the next decade. That's my understanding.
Okay.
Some pessimistic astronomer may think that when galaxies merge, they also very things are very violent, so there's a lot of dust around. So this would these events would be deep in these highly extincted regions, you won't be able to get any signal out of it, basically.
Yeah, I think that's a very fair concern. You'd get it's very possible that some of these sources will be very obscure in the optical, for instance, in the UV. You might hope that in X-ray they show up, or in radio. That's the case, yeah. I think that's a serious possibility.
But isn't, I mean, there's a big delay between the initial merger, which is where you get the activity that obscures, in the final coalescence of the black hole. That could be a billion years later. So this could be quiescent.
That is also possible. I think so. That's why I'm saying, I think some of the sources might be obscured and some might not. I think the answer is we don't know.
Well, the observation could be there, but it may not be from that merger that created the black hole, because of the time scale to get down to the, and then there's the last parsec problem as well.
Yes, and we don't know how long it takes. So I think there's room for everything. If you want to be very pessimistic, it's possible that we will fail in finding any of the information. It's possible. I mean, people will try. That's what I'm trying to say. The astronomers will try, whether they succeed or not. But even if you get one or two, you can do all this, a lot of what I mentioned, I think. So it's worth the effort.
Maybe the same is it true that active galaxies, that we see active galaxies changing the sort of order adding changes in their luminosity, not that infrequently, but don't think that that's due to black hole mergers?
There is some variability in the aliens or something, but it tends to be several tens of percent, maybe factor of two. What I've been telling you about, maybe I didn't clarify this, is a very clear ramp up this time for the precursor with a well defined parallel. So you have some specific expectation for the variation. It's not something that looks quite random. Or the orbital time scale, you know, is something that's very specific. And then this quasar shining on, it should be like nothing, and then after a decade, you should see this quasar shine. So I think the hope is that knowing where to look, when the merger has happened, and having a specific image prediction might help you discard all the other variable things. Yeah. But it's certainly also a concern. And we don't know the answer to the same, because we have not looked at the faint transient sky.
Okay, well, let's think about it.